This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. 801 career goals for the ninth best player in the world, but can we get through a pod without asking about his impact for Manchester United? An enjoyable game, De Gea staying down, Carrick's off, and the balls are flat. Meanwhile, Everton fans are emailing us and asking what is the point as form very much stays in the window in the Merseyside derby. There's Bernardo Silva's volley and boos for Grealish, while Chelsea sneak an undeserved win at Watford to keep the three-way title race trucking along. It's tight below them, a second win for Spurs under Conte, a low-quality Mopai overhead kick means West Ham drop points, while at the bottom, Newcastle and Norwich share some spoils. Also, haven't we all enjoyed Ali McCoist? Should Messi have won the Ballon d'Or? Is it good for England's women to score 20? There's bad maths, Steve Claridge fever dreams, the quest to listen to every single episode of this, your questions, and that's today's, brackets Friday's, Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Ed Ahrens, hello.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm very good. Hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max.
And we should say for the tape, Barry Glendenning is in a suit and tie, or just shirt and tie, which is significantly smarter than you were at the Football Supporters Association Awards, which we will get to in good time. You do look like you're going to court. Have you been discovered? Has the offending jumper, bloodstained jumper, been discovered?
Yeah, that's now Exhibit B. No, Max, today is technically a day off, but because I'm all about giving and selflessness, yeah. I'm doing this podcast and I'm skipping off to Sandown Races for where myself and our colleague James Dart are being entertained by, I think it's British Racing or something. So looking forward to that.
Oh, have a lovely time. You look lovely.
Thank you.
Let's start at Old Trafford. Manchester United 3, Arsenal 2. Ralph Rangnick was there. Carrick picked Ronaldo. He scored 2. But then he decided he was going to leave. He'd probably decided that before. There was a very funny first goal. The balls were flat. John Bruin, this game had everything, didn't it? Did it have everything?
Except two good teams. That's pretty much it. But yeah, I suppose now that Arsenal Man United is no longer the Premier League's blue ribbon fixture, it's better that we see them both slug at each other in this fashion and score silly goals and plenty of storylines, obviously Ronaldo. And then, yeah, obviously the talking point, or it would have been more of a talking point had Arsenal won the game, was Emile Smith-Rowe's goal with David De Gea collapsing to the ground after being tackled by Fred, his own teammate. I think one thing to say about that is that I was watching the Amazon Prime commentary which was the sainted Ali McCoist, and for me, the even more sainted Peter Drury. But I think we've discussed this before, but the bombast with which Peter Drury treats that. Now, that goal was treated like I was saying last night to the chaps on the desk, Peter Drury and Ali treated it as the most unusual thing they'd ever seen in their lives. As if the Loch Ness Monster had held a press conference and announced that they were marrying Bigfoot or something like that. It was just absolutely like, oh, can you believe what you've seen? And really, it was sort of strange. But I'm sure that type of thing has happened before. Ultimately, the fuss over it wasn't or couldn't be anything but a goal. Martin Atkinson delayed it, as he can do now with VAR. And sense prevailed. All this talk of should United be allowed to score another goal in the fashion of that Arsenal should have allowed when, was it Kanu scored against Sheffield United in 1999, was silly talk. But actually, funny enough, that game subsided. Then it becomes the Ronaldo story. And after that, the Michael Carrick story. So plenty to go off.
Yeah, let's start then with that goal. I mean, it was just slapstick funny, wasn't it? You know, and actually I think players do that, goalkeepers especially, go, look, I'm going to go down and say I'm really hurt and they'll have to stop the game and I'll get away with it. And finally, someone didn't get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what he was doing, really. It must have been really difficult for him to have taken to see that ball going in the net after he'd been lying on the floor there, like, and obviously the protest went on. But it was really nonsensical. I think, you know, you have to keep playing on, don't you, if you're a keeper, especially when he must have seen when the ball was cleared that it was still in play. And then at that point, I think you try and get up, don't you? You know, no matter how much pain you're in, you see the ball coming towards, you know, that it might be a goal, and you get on with it, don't you? It was really strange from De Gea, who's had a really good season so far as well. So it's kind of, luckily for them, obviously it didn't matter in the end, but it was complete slapstick.
David says, has anyone pretended to be hurt or ill to disastrous consequences? I don't know if you have, Barry. I there was a cafe near where I lived in London called J&A. Sadly, didn't survive the pandemic, but it had a sort of communal table in the middle. And you quite often put on the communal table. And the trouble was that the bench was too high. So my knees would sort of be wedged under the table. And I like sitting on a chair in a cafe. So when I went in once, they put us on the bench and I said I had a bad back and they moved me to the tables and chairs. But then every time we went back to the cafe, I would have to pretend to have a bad back. So sort of keep the myth going so we could always get a table. They said, how's your back? And I'd completely forget.
Sort of Larry David vibe.
Yeah, totally.
It took me a few moments to figure out what had happened. And then you see, oh, it was Fred. Of course it was Fred. And I was, it crossed my mind. I remember Mario Balotelli's Why Always Me t-shirt. I think Fred should start wearing one of those because he is capable of moments of occasional excellence. But if you were to put a showreel of his bloopers together just for this season alone, it would already be about 15 minutes long. But he did assist one of the goals.
Yeah, and he won a penalty as well. Yeah, you can see why Pep Guardiola was so keen to sign him. And Man United pulled off such a coup to London.
I do like the idea of taking off your T-shirt with Why Always Me after treading on your own goalkeeper and then falling down. So look, Duncan Alexander's tweet, landmark goal for Ronaldo. He has now scored more in the Premier League than Kevin Davis. Look, 801 goals for club and country. From the BBC, there's no central database to establish football's all-time top scorer. Ronaldo tops the charts for official games at a high level, it says. Joseph Bichan, who played in Czechoslovakia and Austria, scored 821 goals in official matches. Elsewhere, his tally is placed at 805. That includes reserve team and non-official international goals. Pelé and Romario both claim to have scored more than 1,000 goals each. Filter out friendlies. Those numbers drop down to the 700s. Unofficial statisticians are SSSF. Say Pelé has 769, Romario, and then Puskas, both on 761, are the nearest players to Ronaldo at the elite end of football. Messi next on 756. It is, Ed, whether we think he can press or not, or whether he's the answer or not, which is a conversation we've had too many times, it is an absolutely astonishing record.
It really is, absolutely. And especially if you consider that at the start of his career, he wasn't, you know, a particularly a goal scorer. He was a winger. He scored the odd goal, but you know, it wasn't until sort of mid-20s that he really started to bang in, you know, the amount of goals that he has consistently since then. And I hadn't heard those comparisons actually until just then. And that is really stunning to think that, you know, even the great Pelé, who made such a great big deal of his 1,000th goal, if you've ever seen that, the footage of that night, you know, to have gone past him is amazing. I have to take your hat off to him.
And his ability, well, the fact he's carried on over 30, and actually you talk about him, you know, as that wispy winger. Like, I was filming a bit, just looking back at all of him and Messi's sort of Champions League careers, and he didn't score in the Champions League for 3 years, I think. And he's so scrawny. And this physical transformation is sort of baffling. Yet at the end of it all, I still, John, think he's the problem, because I've been so Jonathan Wilsoned by all of this.
Yeah, I try not to be Jonathan Wilsoned. Is he the problem?
In every aspect of your life?
Or? Yeah, I think that's not a bad way to live your life, actually. So, yeah, if we can say that, yeah. Well, he's clearly not the problem if he's scoring loads of goals. I mean, you know, there was a stat, wasn't there, that he hadn't scored that many goals at Old Trafford. I'm sure Richard Jolly has rolled out one or two of that. But he's in the Champions League, he's been relentless. And then in the final bow of one of his former teammates, actually Michael Carrick, he delivers a win and a nice swan song. I think my favourite moment, actually, of the game was when he was hunting a hat-trick and he decided, and he, I think the ball broke to Jesse Lingard and then went out to the right-hand side. And Ronaldo decided that he was going to run from one length of the pitch to the other. And then at that point, just pegged out and was subbed off and took so long to leave the field. And then there was a point when he'd been subbed off that it was like he was almost too tired to reach the tunnel to walk off. And he sort of
never lie down.
And he sort of stood at the corner watching a corner being taken. And then, weirdly enough, as soon as he got to the tunnel, he started running again. But, you know,
He did have enough energy to throw his arms up in frustration at Sancho for not passing to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there is always energy for that as far as Ronaldo is concerned. And that's the thing, you know, if you get to 800 goals, you require that appetite and you have to throw away the thoughts of people like Jonathan Wilson and just carry on scoring goals.
Henry Winter, summing up Michael Carrick's contribution to Manchester United, 463 games, 57 goals, 5 titles, 1 Champions League, 1 Europa League, 2 League Cups, an FA Cup. As interim, he steered United into the knockouts in the Champions League, stopped the rot in the Premier League. From dugout to pitch, Carrick delivered. And that's fair, Barry, isn't it? I mean, he was a sensational player.
Yeah, sensational for Tottenham, sensational for Manchester United. He has done an excellent job in his 3 games in charge. Slightly surprised they didn't offer him a 7-year contract on the back of those. But, he leaves. Now, I heard him do an interview with BBC Radio afterwards, and, you know, he said being at Manchester United consumes your life, you know, as a player, and then as a coach, it takes up even more of your time. So, you know, have a few months off. I would imagine he will be in demand as a coach, and he certainly hasn't done his future career prospects any harm with the 3 games he did take charge of.
On Arsenal, Tim Stillman, friend of the pod, Arsenal fan, wrote, "I've watched enough of this team under Arteta to recognise a disconnect between what he says and what his team does. His teams routinely stop playing in advantageous positions. I think it's that simple now. He's pretty ruthless with players that don't carry out his instructions, so it's very difficult to reconcile any other conclusion than his teams stop playing at certain points because that's what they're told to do." Which would be an odd thing to be told to do, wouldn't it, Ed? Get into the final third and stop playing. But look, Tim watches much more of Arsenal than me because I think my general feeling about Arsenal with this defeat and the defeat against Liverpool is they're young, they'll be okay. Give them some time.
Yeah, I think Arsenal have shown some good signs of progress this season, but as you say, it's in the big games where they've really come up short. And yeah, I think you can give them a bit of benefit of the doubt. It is a young team and they need to develop. But I think one of the big issues at the moment is obviously Aubameyang, and the fact that they're the captain, top scorer, talisman, whatever you want to call him, was taken off when they're chasing an equaliser, says quite a lot, I think, about how he's perceived at the moment by Arteta. And you know, they put a lot of money into giving him a new contract, and really he needs to start delivering. Otherwise, it's all very well having a reasonably good midfield and progressive midfield and improving defence, but if your main man isn't putting the ball in the net and isn't really contributing, then it's really hard to see how they're going to get to that next level, you know, and get into the top 4.
The ball was flat at one point. Julien Laurent tweeting, "Marcus Rashford has just told the fourth official, half the balls are flat. This is the Premier League. You'd not have to pump the match balls up in the first half." I mean, you'd hope you wouldn't have to pump them up at all. But I just love the idea of, you know, Man United, the whoever's on the bench next to Carrick, just going, "Has anyone got a pump?" And no one's got a pump. And they have to ask the oppo if they've got a pump.
Someone's got a pump, but no one's got a pin. Oh, exactly. So many times, yeah, no one's... and then you break the pin in the ball.
Was it Ollie that was pumping the balls up? Is that what it is?
Quite possible, yeah.
Ollie's at the pump.
Got any who's got in the WhatsApp group? Who's got the balls? And Fred goes, "They're in my boot." Yeah. And you're like, "Okay, yeah, great."
Ollie's in. Oh, I've got it, but I'm back in Oslo. So
yeah, exactly. I've got the away kit. What are you going to do? Let's go to Goodison. Everton 1, Liverpool 4. Jack says, "How many members of the Townsend family need to be on the pod to turn around Everton's season?" Troy is back on Monday. Michael's written quite a long email, but I'll read it to you. Is there a more aimless plight right now than being an Everton supporter? On paper, the club has ambition. We want to be the gate crashers. Huzzah. But it truly has no direction. Mashiri has set £500 million on fire in transfer fees since he took over 5 years ago. Tonight's derby lineup featured Solomon Rondon, arguably the best player in the world, depending on who you ask, as the target man. He was also up top in what was close to a must-win game at newly promoted Brentford over the weekend. Instead of having some sort of coherent plan, Everton, for the most part, bring in players and managers beyond their prime, creating a roster that's like a starting 11 for the world's worst testimonial match, it says. The result is a team that's too good to ever be in true relegation danger, also too poor to ever come close to a season worth getting truly invested in, yet I still do. As much as it must suck for supporters of clubs that have tumbled, like Leeds or Sunderland or Blackburn, at least those clubs have a mission to get back up into the top flight and turn the misery into something more profound. For Everton, it's like every season since Moyes left had no point. What would have been different if Everton didn't play? Barry.
Well, we have wondered at great length on this podcast, what is the point of Everton? And the reader repeats it there, or listener repeats it there. I wouldn't necessarily agree with his assertion that they're too good to go down, on the evidence of recent performances, and certainly on the evidence of that performance. There's a lot of blame to go around. Mashiri, Bill Kenwright, the director of football, Marcel Brands, his job or position is believed to be under threat. Mashiri told TalkSport yesterday that Rafa Benitez absolutely won't be getting sacked. But as far as I know, there's some very difficult fixtures coming up in the next 3 or 4 games. I can't remember exactly who they're playing, but they're good teams. And, you know, this wasn't just a bad night at the office. It was a terrible night at the office, but it was symptomatic of just the latest in a long run of pretty terrible performances. 2 points taken from the last 24 available. I suppose you have to say that the fact that Dominic Calvert-Lewin, Yerry Mina, Andre Gomes, Luca Dean, Fabian Delph have all been injured isn't helpful. Certainly Yerry Mina and Dominic Calvert-Lewin. But given the amount of money they have spent in the last 5 years, £500 million, that shouldn't be as big a problem as it clearly is.
They've got Arsenal at home, Palace away, Chelsea away, Leicester at home. I mean, that's the thing, because they're Everton. They could lose all of those football matches, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, I think I should say at this point, I may have put the kiss of death on Everton. Not the last time I was on, earlier in the season, you know, when they were riding high. I think they were level on points with Liverpool at one point, weren't they? And I think I said, could see Everton coming as high as sixth this season. And since then, as Barry was just saying, you know, 2 points out of 24, and it's just fallen apart for them. And I think Calvert-Lewin's the really big miss for them. Obviously, he's been out for the whole season and was superb for them for last season, you know, and led the line brilliantly. And they'll be desperate to get him back as soon as possible.
Solomon Rondon, despite Jonathan Wilson's claims that he's the best footballer on the planet, just hasn't been cutting the mustard.
Does he press? Anyway, we don't need to answer that question. Do we then, John, forgive Everton fans for leaving after about 20 minutes? Well, which does seem early, doesn't it?
You've always got to be aware of this. When fans storm out in the first half, this used to happen quite a lot at Sunderland, I seem to recall. I think when David Moyes was manager and various of their other misfiring managers, the bar, I think, is open. So they go for a refreshing drink.
The bar doesn't open till half time, does it?
Well, yeah, but maybe, yeah. I don't know.
Maybe they're going for a long cigarette and then they'll come back.
Or just, they just need a bit of, I just need some quiet time.
Yeah.
I'm really angry. I'm not going to leave, but I just need a bit of time on my own.
Or you need time to speak at closer quarters with more angry Everton supporters so they can all just complain together in a, and you know, I mean, listen, I've a certain amount of affection for Everton, but bloody hell, they moan better than just about any club. I think only West Ham, I mean, you know, Newcastle have done it, but now all is rosy there. But Everton, yeah, just their ability to that groan when Goodison turns. I mean, it's it's like something from a Hammer horror or something like that, isn't it? It's just. I mean, it is quite the. And the other thing about this game is that game actually, the first 20 minutes, they could have been 4-0 down. Then they pull it back to a goal behind and they were doing okay. But then, and at that point, there is hope. You can hear that there is some cheer amongst the Evertonians. But thankfully, there are two more goals and they're able to groan and moan and shout at Bill Kenwright and talk about how Rafa is a copite shite and all this type of stuff. And it's, you know, I mean, there are Evertonians there that will have gone to that game and will have been able to predict and rehearse their entire routine for the evening. And they were able to do that. Are Everton fans happy? I get the feeling that, I mean, there are certain clubs where you get the feeling that fans are happy in misery. And I think maybe Everton are one of those. That it's just become this sort of self-fulfilling thing that if they did get an owner who could turn things round, would it be a bit like Manchester City where you do get some of their fans saying, do you know, it was better when we were away at Lincoln?
It is worth saying, Barry, that Liverpool are really quite good. I mean, Jota's goal was wonderful. Henderson was brilliant. Salah's goals, both brilliantly taken off. The one that took about an hour to get it to go in, I love those slow finishes. They were on, they're on just in such great form at the moment.
Yeah, they've scored 43 goals in 14 games. Look, I don't think anyone was expecting Everton to beat them, and that the form goes out the window cliche. I wasn't expecting form to go out the window. I fully expected Liverpool to absolutely batter them. I think, and they did, and it was another terrific performance from them, and there's not much left to say about how good they are, even though they're still only third. But it was the manner of defeat, you know, it was so abject. And I think Everton fans were going, hoping to be pleasantly surprised, but this relentless football machine from across Stanley Park just steamrolled them, and that is what prompted rage and weary, a mixture of rage and weary resignation, I suppose.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with that Bernardo Silva volley at Villa Park. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Manchester City won 2-1 at Aston Villa. Mark says, which strike would Barry find easier to replicate, Thiago's or Bernardo Silva's?
Thiago's, definitely, yes.
I don't know, actually. I mean, they're both amazing. This goal, Ed, was just sensational, wasn't it? Because
outrageous.
It was the move as well as the finish, right?
It was the move as well, but actually for me, Max, it was the finish. It was all about the finish. It wasn't all about the finish, but 99% about the finish.
Because it's a side foot, that's the key. Well,
I think the key is because it's coming across his body at pace, and it's one of the hardest things technique-wise to do in football, and he just caught it so perfectly. It was beautiful.
It's the sign of a player who's absolutely brimful of confidence and on top of his game that he just didn't think twice about it and did exactly what he intended to do. You know, if Harry Kane was able to score a goal like that right now, one suspects, A, he'd miss it. But if it went in, then the floodgates would open as well.
What about if Timo Werner did it with the floodgates open?
I don't think Timo Werner would even try it.
I still believe, Timo, just in case you're listening. Producer Joel writes, if you could resubmit your top 40 players in the world ever, would Bernardo Silva be higher up? I don't know if anyone did that top 40. Did any?
Well, I haven't done mine yet. I need to do it, essentially. But he certainly deserved to be up there.
I submitted mine on time, unlike Ed. It's not the top 40 in the world ever. It's top 40 this calendar year.
Correct.
Which always causes no end of squawking in the comments section by readers who don't realise it's this calendar year. I can't remember where I had Bernardo Silva, but he was pretty prominent, definitely top 10.
I had him 19th, so I think I need to rethink. That's too late now. Sorry, Bernardo. Yes, John?
Well, I said no. I wrote quite a lot of the profiles, but I wasn't invited to vote, so that's where my standing is. So,
dear,
what a snub!
Yes.
That is brewing.
That's up there with the Mendy snub.
Well, that is absolutely disgraceful behaviour. We would like, on behalf of The Guardian, John, I'd like to apologise.
Yeah. I should be calling Marcus Christensen straight after this.
Yeah, resign in a furious rage.
Well, let's not get too silly, but yeah.
Okay, right. Jack Grealish was on the bench for City. In an interview with The Telegraph this week, he said, I found it a lot more difficult than I thought I would, adapting to a different manager and teammates. At first, I thought I'd have more of the ball, get more assists and goals. It doesn't work like that at all. I've had nowhere near as much of the ball as I used to get at Villa. On Instagram, he said, thank you so much for the great reception at Villa Park. I was like, I'm not sure that's what it was.
Has Jack Grealish ever watched Manchester City before he joined them? What did he think was, you know, I mean, like, okay, you're playing with Kevin De Bruyne, you're playing with players like, you know, Riyad Mahrez and, you know, Raheem Sterling. Does he think they all get their own ball? I mean, you know, and you know, as good a player as Jack Grealish was, and there were times in the Premier League last season when he was possibly the best performing player in the Premier League, Pep Guardiola is not going to say, you just be my Lionel Messi, because he just isn't that player. Now, you know, it's 10 out of 10 for self-reference, but I'm sorry, it didn't really come across that well to me.
But he needs time, right? You know, give him a bit of time. He's a wonderful player, right?
Yeah, no. Listen. I think he's a great player. I just wonder if he's not understanding that he's going to see less of the ball, then it's going to take longer to improve than a player who would come and say, "Okay, I'm here to learn, and you know, I'm prepared to accept my place in the team." I mean, you know, I mentioned it before. I think Riyad Mahrez had a similar problem. He'd been the main man at Leicester. He turns up at City, is a bit part player, and now I would say he's among City's more important players. And I think that's the trajectory that Jack Grealish, despite that £100 million, is probably going to have to follow.
Villa played pretty well, pushed City a bit. Luke says, Nike supply the Premier League with balls and the match officials with kit. I noticed, though, that during the Villa-City game, the ref was wearing Joma boots. My question is, has the ref in question, Mike Dean, got a boot deal? I mean,
it's one for the investigations department, I think.
Absolutely
we'll
right.
Take that on. Get in touch with David Conn.
Yeah.
Get David Conn and Sean Ingle on the case. Has Mike Dean got a boot deal? Let's go to Vicarage Road. Watford 1, Chelsea 2. Chelsea made pretty hard work of this, Ed, didn't they? Thomas Tuchel saying, we were not ready for this game. We are to blame. We never found the right attitude. We were very lucky to escape with the win. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they did what they had to do. It wasn't a great performance by them. But Watford made it quite tough. And obviously there was a big delay as well, which probably wasn't easy for either side, with a, you know, a supporter being taken ill during the first half. But Chelsea will be relieved to have got the job done and you know, move on from that one, because it's Watford have proven difficult for a few teams so far this season. You never really know what you're going to get against them, so they'll be pleased to have got the 3 points going away.
It's funny with Chelsea, Barry. They have won quite a few games in the start of the season as well, where they weren't playing well. And I can't work out if this is just the sign of a good team and they will just keep doing that. They've obviously battered some teams, you know, when their wing-backs score 10 goals each. But I just, of the three, I don't know why I feel they're more likely to drop away. I don't know. I might be completely wrong about that.
Well, a lot of teams play badly and lose, and lose a lot, like Everton. in mitigation for Chelsea here, Thomas Tuchel had to make 6 changes. Now, I know he has great depth of squad, but for that many different players to come into the side, it's understandable they might find it hard to get going. Some seriously key players were out. And Sol Niguez got another chance to impress in centre midfield and didn't take it and was hooked again at half time. That's, I think, the second time he's started and been taken off at half time. And I think I saw somewhere yesterday, I don't know if this is true, but that Chelsea have just decided, look, it's not working, you can go back to Atletico Madrid. But Chelsea have played badly on a number of occasions and won, and I think that's the sign of a good team, definitely.
Sid's on next week. We'll talk to him about Sol Niguez. It's quite an interesting question, I think, as to sort of what has happened there. As you mentioned, Ed, players left the pitch due to a medical incident in a crowd. A fan suffered a cardiac arrest. Watford confirmed on Twitter that the fan was in a stable condition. Saw Luther Blissett tweeting that he'd called him the day after and had a chat with him, so that's good to hear. Start of the second half between Southampton and Leicester as well was delayed by about 15 minutes after a supporter was taken ill as well. In the race for fourth place, Bob says, Man City, Liverpool, Chelsea are much better than everyone else. Who is the best of the rest? John, who's the best of the rest?
Do you know what? I think it's between Tottenham and dependent on Ralphie's pressing game and if he can get Ronaldo to press, Manchester United. Look at Tottenham. They are just 2 points off West Ham with a game in hand. They've had a terrible season so far. There's so much more improvement to come. They've got a good manager. Tottenham really have a chance of getting up there if Conte can do a Conte. So that they're my pick, Tottenham.
And did you see, I mean, I saw green shoots yesterday. It wasn't a brilliant game of football. Brentford didn't really offer much, but you saw Son look better, Skip look better.
Kane not, unfortunately. But yeah.
No.
And the thing is, against a team like Brentford, who were going to run hard, Tottenham were able to run as hard. And that's a good sign. Okay, they'd had that rest against Burnley. But yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, okay, the opening goal was fortuitous, to say the least. That rebound off, I can't remember who headed it off, Kanos's head into the goal, but
It was Janssen into Kanos. Yeah, Ben Davis was just nearby.
Yeah, Ben Davis seems to be the one celebrating. Ben Davis has claimed it, as they used to say in the old days of commentary, but he was nowhere near it, yeah. Yeah, I think if you talk about the improvement within those teams, I think West Ham might have shot it a bit just because they don't have enough players. Arsenal, we've seen Arsenal improve and still be on the fringes. United, there's a definite improvement there. So I do think between Tottenham and United, and at the moment, because we don't know what is going to happen to Ralph Rangnick, it's Tottenham for me because they've got the manager proven at Premier League level.
Is it too early to be getting worried about Brentford? They started with this energy and this real verve, and they showed barely anything. Thomas Frank afterwards said we were really positive, and I was really impressed. And I was like, I wasn't.
Oh, I'm not too worried about them. I think they've got quite a good. They've got the same number of points as Palace, for example. So you know they're in a reasonable position. It's fallen off a little bit in the last few weeks. But they've got so much energy in that team. I'm sure they just need a bit of time to regroup and come again. But they're almost halfway there to doing what they want to do to stay up. They just need to try and find a rich vein of form and get Ivan Toney scoring again because he's been superb for them all season.
So West Ham drew at home to Brighton. Neil Mopay, 4.9 on the Sinclair Spectrum. It was barely an overhead kick, wasn't it? But still a good goal. He said after the game, on Saturday, I was the worst striker in the Premier League. Now I'm not. Which is quite a nice quote. Mark says, do you think the technique employed by Sanchez, the Brighton goalkeeper, of standing behind the goal line to make saves will ever catch on? Southampton 2, Leicester 2. Tanya says, why can't Leicester defend corners? And James Maddison, nice to see him back in good form, John.
Nice finish by him. Southampton and Leicester are two intangible teams for me. I can't really work them out aside from to say that Leicester aren't as good as they were the last two seasons. Southampton, they're almost entering that almost Watford twilight zone for me. They're there. They play every week. I'm just not sure what I think about them. And Ralf Hasenhüttl, you know, is one of the great survivors, you'd have to say, considering the fluctuations in them. Just Southampton, they're just weird.
Newcastle 1, Norwich 1. That Kieran Clarke red card, Barry, in the ninth minute was... That's John, you looked delighted with that. It was very Newcastle. Like, this is not the right thing to do that early in a football match, is it?
No. There was every chance Teemu Pukki would miss. There was every chance that Dubravka would have saved his shot if it had been on target. So it was a rash panic decision. We all make rash panic decisions at bad times in life. And that is one Kieran Clarke will regret. But it was highly amusing to see. And, you know, Dean Smith moaned about the penalty after the game as well. That was also amusing because he had no justification for his complaints whatsoever. Billy Gilmore had a raised arm at a corner and, sorry, that's a penalty. It could be argued that a point isn't much use to either of them, but any point is very precious currency to both those teams at the moment.
Newcastle, just the fourth team to fail to win any of their first 14 games in a Premier League campaign. All the other previous three were relegated. Swindon, 93-94, QPR in 2013, and Sheffield United last season. A quarter of Teemu Pukki's Premier League goals have come against Newcastle. It was a great finish, wasn't it? Mm. Hammered it with his left foot. Leeds 1, Crystal Palace 0. Barry's favourite for the Golden Boot in Qatar 2022, Christian Benteke, missed some decent chances in this game. What did you make of it, Ed, with your Palace hat on?
Yeah, I've kind of gone back to normal now. I went to Palace against Villa on Saturday.
Yeah, that felt very Palace, that game.
Yeah, it was almost reassuring, though, in a way, just to be see Benteke doing what he normally does, missing goals and, you know, people complaining about losing the ball in their own half and stuff like that. It was almost comforting. The first team to face Ralf Rangnick when he's at Man United, so on Saturday. So it's not getting any easier for them, and I think they're going to struggle with that one as well.
Yeah, Philippe Auclair, I think, cursed Mark Gay with that. He tweeted, I'm desperate to watch this wonderful centre-back. He's a totally beautiful player.
He is very good, though, I think.
He is
a real prospect for England, potentially.
I mean, the best moment of this game was that clip that has gone slightly viral of Ali McCoist and John Champion as Rafinha stands over a free kick and Ali McCoy says, this is going to get whipped in with unbelievable pace. That's my prediction. In which Rafinha just absolutely hammers it over everyone for a goal kick. And John Champion says, well, okay, you can redo that bit if you want. And Ali's like, no, I'm sticking with it. I never said how high it would go. And then he bursts out laughing. We were chatting before how we quite liked, you know, this Amazon. Lots of people tweeting how much they like the Amazon coverage. I wonder if it's just because it's a bit different and it comes on twice a year. And we probably feel the same if, you know, BT or Sky were just twice a year. But, I mean, who doesn't love Ali McCoist and John Jack? I've written an article about liking Ali McCoist. That's my strong journalism for this week, Barry. But he is great, isn't he?
I don't know Ali as well as you do, but my limited encounters with him, he's always found him to be a thoroughly nice man. Very funny, has a very sunny disposition, positive outlook on life. He's good fun to listen to on the radio of a morning. And yeah, I would quite like to
be his
have
friend.
Him on co-coms for every game I watch.
Wolves 0, Burnley 0. Wolves beat Burnley 0.74 to 0.25 on XG, which I presume was just that run from Adama Traore that hit the bar when he should have squared it to Raul Jimenez. He sort of had everything. Or Jimenez. I've had some people telling me I'm mispronouncing Raul Jimenez, so hopefully.
It's just good to have Wolves back, though, isn't it? You know, 0-0. Has there ever been a more 0-0 than Wolves 0, Burnley 0.
I mean,
I wonder how many people watch that one.
Yeah, I don't know, like, basically it's Wolves, Burnley, Palace and West Brom in any, although, you know, it was 3-3 the other day, wasn't it? Sorry, Ed. Exactly. But that's just what I imagine they're going to be, nil-nil. So, you know, they did prove me wrong on that occasion.
There's talk that Liverpool and Tottenham, I think, are interested in Adama Traore. And I don't know what to make of him at all, because he clearly has qualities. He's fast, he's strong, but he's only scored 7 Premier League goals in about 150-something appearances, I think, which is a shocking record. But I wonder what would happen if Jurgen Klopp got his hands on him. I think he could turn him into a sensational player, but several managers have, you know, he's halfway there, but he's so... If I was a Wolves fan, I'd be very frustrated with his...
Well, he can't finish. He just can't finish.
He's poor finishing, yeah.
But he is, you know, he's worth the admission fee alone, I would suggest.
Oh, yeah, although yeah.
That goal record suggests he isn't. But he is.
Bruno Lage doesn't seem convinced, and I think it's only started him 7 of their 14 games so far. So
fair enough. All right, that'll do for part 2. Part 3, we'll begin with the Ballon d'Or. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start with the Ballon d'Or. Lionel Messi won it. Silas, did Lewandowski deserve it? Also says, do you think there's too much emphasis for strikers and attackers to win the award, while the evolution in today's goalkeepers should have put a keeper in line to win the award, especially in the last 10 years? Callum says, did the debate of who was to win stop when Messi and family got out of the car in those suits? Lewandowski must have thought, he knows. What did you make of this debate, Ed?
Well, I personally would have gone for Lewandowski, but it was a very tough one this year, wasn't it? There was no outstanding candidate. I just said Lewandowski because of just the amazing goal-scoring record, which surpassed everybody this year, even though he didn't, you know, obviously won titles with Bayern, but nothing else. And it's a difficult one because, you know, Messi had a great year as well, won his first international tournament, top scorer in Spain. So, I mean, it all comes down to the voting, really, doesn't it? And it's mainly done by journalists, so obviously can't be trusted.
Mm. I mean, it does, you're right. It really mainly, in many ways, it entirely comes down to the voting.
Well, yeah.
You're right.
In many ways.
In many ways. I saw you tweeting about sort of the lack of African representation just in the Ballon d'Or in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a disappointing return for African players. Mo Salah came 7th, as everybody knows by now. It's been made quite a lot of. And Riyad Mahrez down in 20th, which was very disappointing as well. And yeah, I mean, just over the course of Ballon d'Or history, I'm not sure if people know this, but only George Weah is the only African player to ever come in the top 3, having been the only African player to win it in 1995. And I just think that is a really poor return, that it doesn't reflect African players' standing in history. I mean, somebody like Samuel Eto'o to not finished in the top 3. Mourinho's commented on this in the past. And then you look at Salah and Mane. Mane actually came 4th 2 years ago, which is the next highest after Weah. And I think that a lot of people were expecting Salah to be maybe at least top 5 anyway. I had a look beforehand and he was 3rd favourite with the bookmakers, which I thought was about right. But yeah, I don't think he was the winner this year, but, you know, I just think he should have been a bit higher.
Lewandowski should have won it last year, and I'm still... I mean, I compared this to the Grand National that never was, Echeness, in 1993, where it was run, but they didn't count the result. I think Lewandowski... why didn't he win this award ahead of Messi? Obviously the Copa America, and I suppose a Latino block vote almost for Messi won that. I think the thing is about he beat Gerd Müller's all time goal scoring record in the Bundesliga. Now people say, okay, Lewandowski is playing for a team that absolutely dominates. They've won 9 in a row, but the thing is, you know, if we're talking about players winning an award for a legacy, well, let's look at Lewandowski's legacy in the Bundesliga. I think before Bayern went on that run of 9 in a row, who won the previous 2 titles? Well, that was Lewandowski. So he is absolutely dominated that league. He is the best centre forward in the world. He beat an all-time greats record. And yet, as you say, Max, when he turned up and he saw the Messi family dressed like they were off to appear in a Disney film, he must have known that the die was cast. And I think he's very unlucky. And it's funny, a Polish magazine messaged me a few weeks ago saying who I thought should win the Ballon d'Or. And it took me about a minute to realise that they wanted me to say that Lewandowski should have won the award. And as soon as I thought about it, I thought, yes, of course he should have won the award. So I think he was very unlucky. I don't think it does that much credit to this award that it's just awarded to Messi and Ronaldo on a rotation. And the other thing, sorry to go on, but there used to be a thing called European Footballer of the Year. There is a South American Footballer of the Year. Not to get too, I suppose, almost Brexity about this, wouldn't it be nice to have an award for the best European player, in which case that player would be Robin Lewandowski, I would say.
I thought Gab Marcotti wrote quite a good piece about just explaining, look, what is this? It's been going since 56. So, like, why do people care? Like, it does predate the European Championships, yellow and red cards, substitutions, etc. You know, it's like it has been going for a long time. And it's 180 journalists from 180 different countries. He does ask, why not 211, since there are 211 FIFA nations? The criteria are three criteria. Individual team performance in 2021 calendar year, 1st of January to the 24th of October. Talent and sportsmanship of player and player's overall career. So I suppose if you take an overall career, like he says in the piece, well, no one's going to get close to Ronaldo and Messi, right? So I don't know. He suggested you could only win it once, like a sort of Hall of Fame thing, and maybe that would make it more interesting.
Yeah,
right?
Like the Wisden Cricketer of the Year.
Yeah, like you hang up the jersey. Barcelona and Spain midfielder Alexia Putellas was crowned the women's winner. Obviously, Barcelona won League and Cup double, first ever Champions League, the first Ballon d'Or for a Spain international male or female since 1960. So congratulations to her. While we're on awards, Barry, we did win the Football Supporters Association Podcast of the Year. Thank you for voting. Most questions were along the lines of Jonathan's. Did Barry clean his phone or did he splash out on a new one? Because you FaceTimed me for the awards, yes, and then took a photo. Photos were taken. And it's a very grubby, it's a disgusting phone screen.
Well, that's just shown up by the camera flashes. Because when I look at it in front of me now, I wouldn't imagine it's any cleaner. It's probably dirtier. It looks fine. So, but thank you for joining us, Max, at what must have been a very early hour of the morning. It was a good night. Good company. It was on a table with Wilson and Miguel and producer Joel and Martin Gritton, former footballer. And we had a very nice time.
Excellent. Well done. Do you remember all the speeches? You had to do three, Barry, which is quite ridiculous. That shows what a state sports broadcasting is currently in.
I had to do three, which the very first award was the Newspaper of the Year. And because our bosses couldn't make it, I was asked, along with Nick Ames and Susie Rack, to collect the award. So that was the first award. So I was completely stone cold sober for that because I'd only had like half a bottle of beer or something. Then the Podcast of the Year award was somewhere in the middle. So I'd had a few glasses of wine there. So I was getting, in my head anyway, more witty and charming. And then, Max, we also won Best Radio Show, you, me, and Charlie Baker, who I'm pretty sure I forgot to thank. But that was
you didn't mention
that was
him.
One of the very last awards, and I was completely obliterated by the time I went up. So it was like the crowd got to see a reverse evolution of man as I repeatedly invaded the stage. So I'd like to apologise to everyone present. And I hope I didn't offend or upset anybody.
Mag says, is a score like England 20, Latvia 0, good or bad for women's football? On the one hand, it's high-scoring games. On the other hand, how have you meant to take this seriously? Susie Rack is joining us on Monday. She wrote a good piece about this, about how basically, you know, this isn't helpful for either England or Latvia. And that discussion of pre-qualifiers is different in the women's game than it is in the men's game. So you could, although I don't think there'd be a terrible idea in both, you could be in favour of them in the women's game and not in the man's game without that being, you know, a ridiculous idea.
Is it in any way interesting that this result and scoreline got a WhatsApp group I'm on of mates, almost none of whom are interested in women's football? It got them talking about women's football, and there was a heated debate going on the WhatsApp group over whether 20 is, you know, whether you should show your opposition mercy, you know, leave it at 7 or 8, or keep putting the hammer down and try and beat them by as much as possible. Now, I'm sure, lots of Latvian players couldn't play because they couldn't get time off work. That shows the difference in the chasm in quality between the sides. But I think even the fact that it got a gang of lads who have no interest in women's football talking and arguing about women's football, surely that is one point in its favour.
We'll do more with Susie on Monday on that. Plenty of emails that we'll try and get through as many before producer Joel tells us to shut up and go away. Thank you for coming to the live show. Those of you who did, with reference to the halftime show, Dan says, I usually have some biscuits or a packet of crisps while watching something before bed. Last night, there were no snacks in the house, so I was forced to make do with some apples with peanut butter and some strawberries. My late night viewing of choice was the Football Weekly live show. It just so happened that I'd paused it just before the halftime show. So as it turned out, I ended up eating fruit in bed in perfect synchronization with Steve Claridge. This is without doubt the strangest yet most intimate experience I've ever had. Newfal says, I logged into the Guardian live show right at half time and genuinely thought it was a link issue and closed the video since it was early morning in Melbourne. Hilarious now as I watch it on demand. Yes, many thanks to Steve Claridge for eating a bowl of fruit for 15 minutes, which was the live show. I think tickets are still available if you think that is worth £7, along with very sober me and not quite as sober rest of panel. It was early in the morning for me. This is from Joe, who says, morning, Max, Barry, and most importantly, Wilson, he says. I was listening to Monday's pod yesterday, and I sort of had an out-of-body experience when Jonathan Wilson told the story about his glass-topped garden table cracking in the storm at the weekend. My glass-topped garden table suffered exactly the same fate in the same storm. The way he described it was exactly what had happened to mine. But that's not all. He also mentioned his neighbour's cat that sometimes goes in his garden, so he wanted to clear up all the broken pieces. I have a cat and had the same dilemma. I didn't want her going out there. And so I was also out in the garden in the dark trying to clean up all the broken glass. It was tempered glass, which apparently is supposed to shatter into smaller, less dangerous, sharp pieces. It took ages, and doing it by iPhone light was very difficult indeed. I wonder if I was out in my garden clearing up the same sort of glass at the same time as a result of the same storm as Wilson. I really hope so. A lot of people were upset with Wilson's maths when we were discussing how long it would take to listen to every single episode of Football Weekly from 2006. Christian says, has he already eaten humble pie after his horrendous maths mistake on his last appearance? Are all his numbers wrong? Has he lied about his age? Can he be trusted, in capital letters? Amy says, on the last episode, Wilson estimated that the entire history of the podcast would take over 600 days of playing time to listen to completely. Using his estimate of 1,500 hours of pod content, it would indeed only take 62 and a half days of continuous listening, a factor of 10 or less. Achievable? More so. Worth it? Absolutely not. Well, Cara got in touch to say she was trying to listen to all of Football Weekly since 2006. And thank you to Arjun, who says, I just listened to yesterday's Football Weekly episode while on a cold 10K run, and I enjoyed listening to Cara's quest to listen to every single episode. I recently just finished the exact same task, which I started in the summer of 2019 and finished in May this year. Listening to the pod from the very beginning, when it was recorded in near-Earth orbit for the 2006 World Cup, right until the present day, made the pod a constant presence in my life. It was there just before I started my final year at university. I'm now in a settled graduate job over 2 years later. It helped that the podcast became available on Spotify in recent years, enabling me to listen to pods on 1.5 speed. I averaged 2 to 3 pods a day, almost every single day. Listening when on holiday on the way back from nights out during these long days in lockdown, from the Euros this year onwards, I've been able to listen to all up to date. Yet the thrill of being able to relive memories of yesteryear was a great experience, particularly as I properly got into football during the 2006 World Cup when I was 7. Keep up the great work. Congratulations on the awards. Here's to many more years of listening to the pod. I hope Cara is able to complete the task in a similar time frame to me. Isn't that lovely?
Three a day.
I wouldn't do three a day. I find one is three a week. I find enough.
Oh wow,
that is commitment. Great commitment.
It really is, isn't it? Thank you, Arjun. You're the winner. Raphael says, please, 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 can we get a happy birthday shout out from Barry to my brother Tom Pitts, who lives in Sydney. He's a huge fan of the pod and got back into football largely because of it. Barry is his favourite. Also, if you could possibly say it in a typically Barry way, you can read into that whatever you like, Barry. Tom Pitts.
I hope you have a very happy birthday, Tom Pitts. You big fucking idiot.
Okay, there we are. True to form. Give the people what they want. And look, thanks to everybody who got in touch about Spotify Unwrapped. John, I'm sure yours and mine were pretty similar. Nelly Furtado's I'm Like a Bird was
yes,
worryingly high for me. I mean, I don't dislike the song, but that did surprise me. Bit of Natalie Imbruglia in there as well. Did you have those two?
No, my most played song of last year was, or this year, was Foot Stomping Music by Bo Hannon.
Right.
Yeah, so check that one out, Pop Pickers.
Yeah. Is that a low tempo one, John? It's the nice chilled one there, yeah?
Not really. Check it out. It's a very good song.
Sound of the Summer?
Sound of the Summer of 1974, I think. My two most played bands were these hip, new, happening bands. They're called The Rolling Stones and The Beatles. Yeah. So check them
out. Do you know
out.
What? I haven't seen the Beatles documentary, but I have listened to a lot of Beatles since, just because they're sort of, you know, in my mind. And turns out, pretty good, everybody.
Quite a good band, yeah.
Yeah. So listen, the Spotify Unwrapped thing. James says, Spotify Unwrapped told me I spent 1,600 minutes listening to you this year. It's probably longer than I've spent talking to my parents. Can I have an award? 1,600 is nothing. Ben got to 9,300. The record was Marcus, who got 10,200 minutes. So thank you to everyone who got in touch to say they'd spent thousands of minutes listening to us. As Philippe Auclair and our mate Stu Braithwaite from Mogwai both tweeted out, if you do listen on Spotify to music, go and find the band and buy some of their music is a good thing to do. Yes, producer Joel says, go and buy Football Weekly on vinyl.
Can I just say, I've got two copies of Foot Stomping Music on vinyl. So there you go.
Good man. So yeah.
It's that good.
And look, thanks so much as well for the reaction to the pod we did about misogyny in football. It's got a really good reaction and we appreciate that. And I don't know if we came up with any answers, but it was an important conversation to have. And that's enough. Thank you. Blimey, this is getting self-indulgent, isn't it? Barry, have fun at the races/in court. Hope you get off.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Ed.
Cheers, Max.
Cheers, John.
Cheers, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.